John Hanson here. Patrick Golan to my left. Hey, Patrick, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Employment lawyer.
Beautiful day.
To my right is Mike Leonard in chair number two. Hi, Mike, how are you?
John, how's it going, buddy?
I'm good. I hear, before we get into the Coldplay thing, which you don't really want to do it anyways.
The Coldplay thing is just too tawdry. Too tawdry for me.
You don't want to get down to that level
and talk about it?
The kiss cam gone wrong.
The federal criminal defense attorney doesn't want to.
Well, he doesn't want to deal with that. He first has a confession for us, though, Patrick, apparently.
Okay.
Speaking of federal criminal defense, I have a confession. So it could both make and ruin your day. So I was sitting outside the MCC jail this morning to go visit somebody. And as I was sitting there, I'm like, oh, I want to get the sandwiches for everybody from La Petito.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the order in my phone, and I'm like, okay, I'll just keep it until I get out, right? So then I go to the parking garage here, or go to the parking garage, and I'm trying to get the parking thing. And instead, I press the order, the pending order that's sitting there with no ability to get the sandwiches. So I'm going to have to pick up the sandwiches after the show, but I'm not coming back to give you.
No,
I'll give them to people on the street, maybe my children, but you're not getting a sandwich. Sorry, Iridian, you're the only one in this building who's deserving of that.
But John, she won't be getting one.
No, but she won't be getting one.
I was wondering why you came in empty-handed, but I wasn't going to say anything.
We actually have a confession for you.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Before you showed up, I said, I hope Mike brings sandwiches next week, because there was pizza on Hochberg's show. You admitted you were full.
I just had breakfast.
And we were just like, he's going to bring in these great sandwiches. And we have to eat them in front of him, even though we're all full.
Wow. Well, so, that's going to motivate me not to bring you a sandwich.
No. Next week, we're going to be ready for your sandwich.
Yeah,
Iridian?
No breakfast.
Iridian wants a sandwich next week. So does Patrick. So do I.
I think I'm going to have to punish you by giving you only a half.
Why don't we just admit that was kismet and it worked out perfectly?
Okay.
All right, great.
Yeah, but it still cost me $46.
Well, give them
just put
them
in the fridge for a week from now.
Pass. That's like there's an episode of The Simpsons like that. It doesn't work out too well for Homer.
Probably not.
Okay, Coldplay.
Yeah.
They're doing a concert.
Yeah.
And I haven't dove into this as much as Iridian has dove into this. She has all the tea. But essentially, they have this circular jumbotron, and they put a woman and a guy behind her clearly dancing. Like a loving couple.
Hugging from behind.
Mm-hmm. With swaying, light swaying. They definitely look like a couple. So as soon as they get on the jumbotron, there's always a split little delay. And boom, he and her duck out of there, leaving behind one other person just smiling there and laughing. And Coldplay, I believe it, calling it out and saying, uh-oh, that was an affair or something. I mean, if they had just stood there and swayed, no one would have ever posted this video. It had never gone viral, but they clearly did something. And then it was found to be this CEO of this company and the head of HR.
Go ahead. It's classic criminal law. It's the cover-up that gets you.
Yeah.
It's not the crime. Right. It's the cover-up.
Well, it's the attempted cover-up.
Yes.
Yeah.
So now the latest, Patrick, is, there's a lot going on, but his company has put him on leave, right?
Yeah.
Is that typical? Is it because of just the media circus that somewhere in his contract it says something along the lines of shall do nothing to bring negative stuff towards our company? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so as the CEO of the company, he's going to have a pretty detailed employment agreement. He'll have clauses with regard to misconduct, right? And he'll have to abide by the code of a company policy. And he can't undertake action that would bring about disrepute to the company, anything that harms the company's reputation publicly. That's part of it, okay? There's so many different parts to this. So I have represented the woman in this situation where ostensibly in a relationship with her boss. She was chief marketing officer. He was CEO.
Okay.
I've represented.
Tawdry.
Yes, it is, Mike. Yeah. Sorry. I'm going to get into some detail,
Mike.
Can we put this under seal
so the listeners don't have to hear this?
And I've represented the CEO who's been accused of this issue. So here's the problem. The company has liability, obviously, if the woman brings a claim. Now, of course, it seems consensual between the two, and that's what they both think. But at some point, it may not be. The person in her circumstance may say, you know what, I felt too much pressure to have this relationship. It actually wasn't voluntary. He made me do it. I was afraid for my job, et cetera, et cetera. So that kind of claim is exactly what the company doesn't want. So most companies have policies that do not permit romantic relationships between employees, or more specifically, between supervisors and subordinates. That's part of it for him. But the other part is he's got a big severance package that he's ostensibly, I'm not saying maybe, the person in his circumstance usually does have a big severance package unless he's terminated for misconduct or violation of the code of conduct policy. So there's a lot of ramifications under this sort of situation. Obviously, I don't know his contract, but it probably provides for a bunch of stuff like that that he may not be entitled to.
I mean, the people you represented, though, didn't go viral for their actions.
They didn't,
which brings the company's name through, I don't know if through the mud's the right term, but that adds a complicating factor to it, right?
It does, but both, you know, other employees who are aware of the relationship may not, you know, may have concerns about, are they being treated fairly? Is the CEO of any company who has a relationship with a subordinate like that treating her better than others at her level? So there's a whole bunch of different things that the company has to be concerned about, not just publicly, but internally. What do people think? It's very hard on morale when that happens. And so there's, you know, concerns with claims from the woman and the guy, you know, the person, CEO, if you know, he's terminated for quote-unquote cause, which is really misconduct.
He actually just resigned.
He did?
It just came across.
Okay. Wow.
Thank you for the texter for pointing it out. And yeah, I just pulled it up. Astronomer, is that the name of the company?
Astronomer, yeah.
Andy Byron resigns after Coldplay Kiss Cam video.
Man.
Well, could there be an agreement between the company?
So here's what's gonna probably happen is he will probably negotiate or attempt to negotiate some sort of separation package, claiming that what he did was not sufficient, quote-unquote, cause to terminate, you know, in a way that does not required the company to provide for severance pay. So there's more to go, I'm sure, between the CEO and the company, even though he left.
Well, okay. I'm sure he got the deal before he agreed to resign, because then he had no leverage, but I mean, I'd be hard to believe he's not going to get paid. And then the HR person's in a difficult spot, because obviously they're the one who's supposed to be monitoring subordinate relationships and then is involved in that. But then there's always that kind of thing where, you know, the kind of somewhat of a double standard, like, okay, we can't take action against her. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there.
And I'm sure Karen would have some thoughts on the family law aspects of all this.
Yeah, she's not married. He is. But also, you know, I don't anticipate that someone in her position will remain in the company either. So she's going to negotiate a package as well.
Mm. It's just so funny because, like, obviously it's on the top of people's minds. We talk about it on the radio. If everyone waits a week, I mean, everything just dies down. I mean, unless it doesn't until you get an announcement like a resignation. I mean, I'm not saying that that should change how the company decides to do what they do, but I think all these things happen so fast because we all happen so fast in terms of our consumption and reaction to news. Whereas in a day, there's going to be the next big thing that goes viral that distracts all attention away. I wonder if companies these days, correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, they kind of like almost overcompensate quickly, too quickly, to try and fix scenarios that no one's going to give a crud about in 72 hours.
Yeah, I don't think they're concerned about the public perception nearly as much as the, you know, claims that may come from her or other employees. You know, that regardless of whether the issue dies down publicly or not, this would happen. He would leave. She will probably leave, under my experience with circumstances like this. I'm just saying.
Tawdry.
John, I got one question for you. Can you even give me one line of lyrics from a Coldplay song? I don't think you can. Those aren't lyrics.
Who ruled the world? And it was all yellow. Look at the sun, how it shines for you.
Why did you ask that question, Mike?
I was a college radio station DJ in the years 2004 to 2007 when Coldplay had a lot of great hits, Mike.
John, I gotta tell you, you fooled me there, because I love Coldplay. You know, because I would say, John, you're a sky full of stars. How about that one?
That's good. They're playing in Madison tonight. My sister's going to the concert, and I said, bring a phone. You never know what's going to happen.
They're playing in Madison?
Oh, yeah. Cool.
At Camp Randall Stadium, football stadium.
We don't do Kiss Cam anymore at the United Center.
For that reason?
I don't know if it's for that reason. I think it's for a host of reasons.
I think people don't.
The world's a lot different than it used to be 7 years ago, just actively, openly asking people to make out on camera. Honestly, to me, it's a little move, too.
I agree.
But we do put people on the video board, and it was not a Kiss Cam. That's what people are calling it, but it was just, here's two people enjoying the show. And what?
No, nothing. Sorry.
So I guess what I'm saying is like, anyone out there, first of all, don't have affairs. Second of all, don't do them in places where...
Public.
Yes. Public places. I wander around the United Center with a microphone. Yeah. You've seen it.
Yes, I have.
And I talk to people. And there's been a couple times I've talked to someone and asked, like, are you guys together?
Yeah, right.
And you get, like, the weirdest answers. And the audience absolutely knows what's going on. So...
But the audience
but yet
loves
you keep answering.
Oh, the audience loves
they
it.
They love the
Is that why
cam.
You ask the question?
I love it.
I know.
I don't do it for that. I try and find a good moment. Maybe they're here on their 10th wedding anniversary and we get the whole crowd to go, oh, yay. But if they're like, we're here. Okay, that happens.
I think you should reintroduce the Kiss Cam to Bulls Cams because people love that.
I don't run. I don't do the Bulls.
Okay.
Well, do you want me to maybe send that up the chain?
Yeah, maybe you should.
I don't think people love the Kiss Cam,
okay.
To be honest with you.
All right, well, we'll put that to the listeners. 312-981-7200. Did have a text for you, Patrick. Oh. Are non-competes signed when an employee signs it in exchange for severance enforceable? Is that an
That seems like we have one too many signs there.
Okay, but it's a non-compete signed at the moment of the severance. Do you hear that a lot?
So if you don't have a non-compete and you're leaving and then it's included in a proposed separation agreement.
That's probably what it is, okay. Part of a separation
So you didn't
agreement.
Have it before. So now you're leaving, you have it in there.
Yes.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, if you get something for it, of value, like some additional compensation.
But what if it's what if they're offering the same severance package they've offered everyone else, and now they're putting this clause on it of a non-compete?
No. That you have to have something in addition to that called consideration. You have to get something.
Well, that's what I think that...
That's the question?
Something to look, no, I think that would be something to look into.
That's a starting point.
Because if someone is, as we've talked about, severance, it matters not only what's in the handbook. It matters in practice what the company has done for mm-hmm. years and years. If they give every person that they give that they let go, you know, 2 months severance, and then they offer you 2 months, but you need to sign a non-compete to get it, that doesn't seem to be okay, right?
No, it's not. It's not enforceable because you didn't get anything of value for that obligation. So they'd have to give you something extra on top of that 2 months.
Okay. 312-981-7200 if you have any employment law questions. Mike Leonard, I want to pivot over to you. You've just been reacting the whole show, talking about sandwiches and tawdry affairs and singing Coldplay lyrics. How's life with you? You're a busy guy.
You saw the viewership spike when I did
listenership.
Singing.
Yeah, the singing, I saw that.
Oh, yes. It did. I saw, we have the numbers right in front of us at all times.
I think dogs were howling.
I do have one of the worst voices ever, but it does not stop me from using it. Just been pretty busy. Got a couple trials coming up in federal court, and then we have one in state court downstate later in August. That's a murder case, but we have federal fraud, federal carjacking cases coming up. So just a lot of trial prep on different fronts. And then this past week, we had a significant sentencing that I was telling you a little bit about mm-hmm. how moving it was, because you can never kind of predict how the defendant will perform in terms of addressing the court at a sentencing hearing. And you typically, of course, want them to if they're capable of doing it. And so I wasn't sure how it was going to go with my client, but he did a remarkable job of just speaking from the heart and a lot of non-dry eyes in the courtroom, including me. I will cry at a Hallmark, Hallmark special sure. when they break up before they get back together. So yeah. It was extremely moving. And more importantly for us is that, the government was seeking a gargantuan sentence and the judge gave far less than that gargantuan sentence. So, we felt in certain ways it was a victory for us. And that's sometimes how you win, by keeping your client out of prison for an extended period of time. Under the right circumstances, so we felt good about that.
It's called the allocution, right?
Correct.
And we've talked about in the past kind of that fine line of admitting you did something wrong, even if you just spent months saying you didn't. And you also might, I don't know if you guys are appealing the case or if someone will, but in appeals, you may be arguing something different than what your allocution said. But you want to, judges want to see that remorse. It's a hard line to toe.
Yeah, it depends on the circumstances. Obviously, the recent one in the Madigan case where he kind of went all in and did really not show remorse, accept responsibilities, maybe in a kind of oblique way he did, but he didn't hit it on directly. There are certain cases where the sentencing consequences are so draconian that you can really help yourself by falling on a sword, accepting responsibility, showing remorse, showing respect for the victims. And that's something you may tactically decide to do because you realize what the consequences are otherwise, and the fact that the judge may use that as strong motivation against you to make your sentence longer than you might want it to be. Other cases, you can still express those sentiments without saying, I did it, and here's how I did it. You know,
right,
so
right,
you,
right.
You, there's a lot of different ways to do it. But yeah, it's a very a nuanced approach, and also just kind of preparing your client as to what to say, how to say it, well, you know, what they shouldn't be saying. It's not their job to argue on the sentence or to argue, re-argue the case, or really to argue about their past. It's really to kind of express, you know, what they've learned from it, how things are going to be different.
Do they write it out ahead of time?
Some do, some don't. The guy for Friday had it all written out, a couple pages. Of course, we talked about the importance of, you know, making eye contact with the judge, stopping, you know, not just reading from the paper. But that's also hard to do. Everyone's not, doesn't have a lot of experience doing that in public. So, you know, people are more or less equipped to do that. But
especially when your life is on the line.
Yeah, he did a remarkable job, spoke from the heart. What he had in the paper was great. He broke down. People in the audience broke down. So I think it wasn't a game. It was effective in a meaningful way.
Do you defer to them? I know it's your. I mean, there's a lot of good advice you can give, but at the end of that conversation about what they're going to say to the judge, do you defer to them? What if they say, I am not going to show contrition or et cetera, et cetera. You say, well, then here's the possibility if you don't. But at the end of the day, you'll just let them do whatever they're going to do?
Well, you can't stop them, of course. So, right. I mean, all you can do in the strongest, most uncertain terms is try to explain to them, you know, what is a good approach in your professional opinion, what you think the judge is expecting here and anticipating here, why certain things they want to say, although they might feel good, and they might feel good at the time, and they might, in their view, settle a score or make them feel better about speaking out, that the consequences could be very bad for you. So all you can do is your best professional opinion, trying to persuade them, try to cut things out. But if they want to say something, there's no way to stop them.
312-981-7200 for your thoughts. It's kind of like me with you. There's no way you can stop me from stopping you talking when we have a news break coming up.
We can't stop you talking
when we're on this. And there go the microphones. Time for the news on WGN. Patrick Dolan to my left, Mike Leonard to my right, and Jim on the phone line with a question. Good afternoon, Jim. Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
What do you got for us?
I've been following the Diddy case quite a bit. I just had a question for Mr. Leonard. Like, does he think that this was like a mistake on the prosecution's part to go after, you know, the racketeering charges and sex trafficking? Like, it seemed like they didn't really have any credible or even any witnesses to those charges.
And so, like, you think, you wonder if they overshot their shot?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what was their strategy here, and what did they do wrong?
I totally agree with you, Jim. I mean, it's very common for prosecutors, including at the federal level, to overcharge cases, to charge as many counts as they can, with, of course, the idea that it makes it very difficult to run the table on not guilties. But in this case in particular, it's kind of striking that you had a RICO case. So if the listeners remember, that means that they had to prove that he wasn't just a singer or guy, but he was running a criminal enterprise. But all they really did to establish the criminal enterprise was go with people that he already had relationships, like his girlfriend. I'm not excusing his conduct, but they didn't establish that he had all these people that were actually running a criminal enterprise. So I think it was a huge tactical mistake to think they could get a conviction and only put on like the girlfriend or a couple girlfriends. But I think that maybe at the time they charged it, they thought they'd get cooperation for a lot more people in terms of testifying. But I think most people wanted nothing to do with that case, didn't want to admit they were part of it, didn't want to admit their knowledge of things. So it made it very difficult for the government to prove a criminal enterprise. So therefore, they were left some counts, which was still some serious conduct, of course. But of course, he'll get a much lighter sentence. And based upon the fact he's already been in jail the entire case and until sentencing, whatever sentence he get will, of course, reduce that time. So he may have very little time to serve still. But I agree with you, Jim. I mean, classic case of prosecutorial overreach.
They got him where they wanted him in one way.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the charges they could get. But does it justify an 8-week trial and spending millions of dollars and using all those resources on a case where you can argue they did not have a good faith basis they could get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt on those counts? I don't think they had one.
Do you think that paints the federal office that brought the charges in a bad light?
Of course. Like, just like any other jurisdiction where you overcharge or overreach and charge things with people with crimes where you can't, you know, realistically prove them guilty beyond reasonable doubt. That's not good. It's not good for the system. It's not good for prosecutors to do that. I'm not saying it happens all the time. I'm certainly not saying it ever happens in Chicago. But
of course,
it's always a problem.
So the way I look at it, and maybe you do, is I when I'm thinking about claims to bring in a civil lawsuit, employment-related, I don't want to bring claims that I may have a tough time surviving a motion to dismiss or a summary judgment motion, because to me, a lot of it is credibility.
Yeah.
If there's five possible but two really good, I'm just gonna file the two good ones, because it makes my job so much easier. And in terms of proof, in terms of what I have to show ultimately at a trial, et cetera. So the government doesn't think of it that way? Is that what you're saying?
Unfortunately, they don't. I mean, All over the country, prosecutors are always accused of overcharging, because they do, because it's a tactical move. Charge as many offenses as you possibly can. It's very difficult in front of a jury to run the table on all counts.
But if they think that you broke the law in all those cases, why should they not do that?
Well, John, they should have sufficient evidence that they know going in they can prove the case in good faith beyond a reasonable doubt. And sometimes I don't believe they do.
Just because the jury didn't agree with them doesn't mean that they didn't go for it with good faith, good base.
It's not what you're saying, though.
It's not. I'm saying when they charge the case, you still have to have a good faith basis that you can prove that you can win the case, that you have sufficient evidence to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. In the Diddy case, when they charged racketeering, I don't believe they had a sufficient good faith base to believe, with the evidence they have, unless some of it went away or people wouldn't cooperate, that they had a realistic good faith basis they could prove those charges, that particular charge, beyond reasonable doubt.
Is there a way, and I generally agree with you, I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate side of thing of what prosecutors would probably say, because we don't ever have them in here, because they're, you know, working a hard job. They're not like you, Mike Leonard. They just pop in, you know, you defend some people,
bring some sandwiches,
pop in on the show, bring some sandwiches, yeah, sing some Coldplay,
go to a wedding or two, you know.
I'm just kidding, Mike.
He works really hard.
He does.
He looks mad.
He really does.
No.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, for years, Congress put mandatory minimums. There were judges that had to do certain things certain ways. Congress probably does have the authority, maybe in conjunction with the Department of Justice, to come up with legislation that would limit prosecutors' ability to do a Christmas tree laundry list of charges. Do you never see that as an option?
No, it's no option. That's the problem. Every case is dependent upon individual facts and circumstances, what the investigation supports. So you can't say, gee, you can only charge five counts, you can charge three counts. No, you're relying upon the good faith of the prosecutor's offices, wherever they are, to do that. So, yeah, if a prosecutor was on here, they would entirely disagree with me. We just won't let him in the studio. But based upon your comments, if you get charged with a crime, don't call me.
But what about if you're a juror, though, and you're sitting there and you've got 10 charges and you think 8 of them are total stretches and you're listening to this for days, weeks, months?
And 10 would be a light one.
No, but my point is that after all that time, you're like, you didn't even put on evidence even close to show beyond a reasonable doubt. I'd have a hard time with the stuff where you did have where they really did have good evidence. Well, that's just a human reaction, I think. Why are you overreaching? Like, to me, it's a credibility problem.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe that would run the table the other way in terms of not guilties, but it usually doesn't. But you're also coming at it from a perspective of a lawyer. And, you know, when you're charging a RICO racketeering enterprise against an individual or a band or a singer, it's very technical. There's all these elements. There's elements and there's definitions of elements and there's definitions of definitions. And so people, I don't think, are sitting there thinking, wow, they could never prove this. They're really struggling with all these individual elements and trying to apply the jury instructions, especially in a case like that. But I get it. I mean, there could certainly be a backlash in a given case that, gee, we think this prosecution is unfair. We don't think the charges should have been brought, and you're going to pay the price, government, by, you know, complete not guilty. But sadly, that doesn't always happen.
Or the opposite. They look at a bunch of charges and they say, now, I don't necessarily believe all these, but look, the government's brought 18 charges. We can't find them not guilty. He or she not guilty on everything. Let's pick a couple of these. And they don't realize that just a couple can do what the prosecutors wanted in the first place.
I wouldn't look at it that way at all. I'd look at it the other way. I'd have a real credibility problem with them just throwing stuff against the wall.
Mike, tell us, who's right, Patrick or me? What do juries usually do?
I can't pick a side. But anyways, one of the issues you just pointed out, which is always a problem for us on the criminal defense bar, is that, you know, there is this notion, at least in our heads, that if you have a multi-count case, that, and you have to try to emphasize this in your closing argument to the jury, like, look, it's not, let's make a deal. It's not a compromise. It doesn't help us. It doesn't help the system. It doesn't help the defendant. If you say, oh, gee, well, you know, we'll give the government one count or two counts or whatever if it's not there, that doesn't help anybody. But we always worry that if in a multi-count case, there'll be this give and take, this compromise that, oh, well, you know, maybe he didn't do this or she didn't do this, but, you know, we'll find him guilty on this count. Maybe even though the evidence isn't there. I think it happens all the time, Patrick. You're shaking your head, but I think that's the danger we feel as defense lawyers.
Do you flat out tell the jury this in a way?
Sometimes, yeah.
Look at these insane laundry list
right.
that they're trying to get it on. Right. Do not just fall into this trap of, well, he's got to be guilty of something.
Like you're sitting here for weeks, jurors, and, you know, for what? They're not even close to proving their burden.
Well, yeah. Take an example like a federal court case of wire fraud. Okay, so there might be 7, 10 counts of wire fraud. That might be the only counts charged, but there's multiple counts, right? And you do say sometimes in your closing argument, look, finding him guilty, or he or she on one count, you know, can be just as devastating as finding them all. If the evidence isn't there, you know, this isn't game of let's make a deal or let's compromise or let's give the government something. Or I'll say that because from a sentencing consequence, sometimes the consequences are exactly the same, but you can't talk about sentencing, but you know in your head, a conviction on one count of wire fraud can be as bad as on five, right? So it's always a dangerous game when you're at the defense side and you're up against a multiple count case, which is what happens all the time.
All right, so you try and level with the jury and just say, look, I know the temptation is there to let's find one, but that's not your job.
Correct.
Try and lump in maybe uncertainties in some of the bigger charges and have those trickle down to the lower ones.
Well, yeah, you got to address them all, but you have to be mindful of the fact that in a multi-count case, there's that danger and there's that bargaining that goes on in the jury room. And who knows? Maybe I'm completely wrong, but that's how I view it.
Oh, Jim, you asked that question 9 minutes ago. Did we answer it for you?
Yeah, you did, but I have a follow-up because Mr. Leonard kind of touched on it. Is it possible that the prosecution were leveling all these charges as a ploy to get a pretrial plea? And they're like, look, you're staring down the barrel of all these charges. Just plead guilty to these three, and we'll put you away for 10 years or whatever. And like, isn't that possible? And then did his team just call the bluff and said we're going to trial?
Oh, Jim, no question. That happens all the time, and it is a tactical thing. It gives them incredible plea negotiating leverage. Imagine that. In any case, this happens all the time. Happens in a case I have this week where it looks like we're going to reach a deal, where it's a multi-count case, and they're like, hey. You know, they started out at like some crazy deal, you know, so-called deal, and now we're down to something reasonable. But they were able to leverage the fact that, hey, look, guys, you know, if you don't win on all these counts, it's going to be pretty bad for you. The sentencing consequences are going to be draconian, and it goes into any defendant's mind, of course.
All right. Good question, Jim. Sorry, you talked for 40 seconds, and we talked for 14 minutes. 312-981-7200. Got one more segment left with these guys, and a few more minutes left with Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, if you couldn't tell, and Patrick Dolan, our employment lawyer, who's mad at prosecutors today.
Why aren't you, Patrick, talking about the biggest story of the day?
Okay, what's that?
It is unbelievable.
Here we go.
A twisted big law summer intern, this is today's story, was tossed.
Wait, what site is this from?
New York Post, legit.
Okay.
Yeah. Was tossed from an elite Manhattan law firm, which is Sidley & Austin, one of the biggest firms in the country. After repeatedly baring her teeth and nothing but the teeth. She reportedly was roaring at her colleagues and biting them, not in an aggressive way, but a faw, quirky, manic pixie dream way.
And
she was fired.
Like literally biting.
Yes. Like in a fun
know,
way. How do you
how
bite someone
no,
in a fun
could
way?
I miss that? I'm sorry,
that's
Mike.
That's crazy.
I didn't read that
this
story.
This also happened recently at a fan convention for some old show where two stars of a show that do these like fan conventions, the two stars had like a little miffy thing because one of the guys, Dean Richards was talking to me about this when I was filling in for Bob Surratt. One of the guys was biting the girls and they were like, you're no longer part of this fan convention.
Yeah, that's
anyways, can you bite people at work?
Can you physically? You know, I not a good idea. Wait, did you say that she was fired by
Sidley? She was fired.
Yeah,
but she did. They said the body count, meaning how many people she bit, was in the double digits. But can you imagine how bizarre that is? Like, think back to your days when you get your summer intern jobs.
Stressed.
Oh, she was an intern.
Yeah. When you get your summer intern jobs at a law firm and you're in law school.
Yep.
You are so on guard.
Yeah, you
like
are.
You're trying to do everything
you're
perfect.
Paranoid.
You're worried about your
you're
suit.
Sweating.
You're worried about your dry cleaning being perfect.
Yeah,
you're worried
absolutely.
About getting stuff in on time. Imagine like doing anything like that. It's insane.
Well,
but biting your college?
Great for a great newspaper article, though.
It does. I'm sorry I missed that. Yeah, I'm not surprised she was terminated. You know, I think, but, you know, she may have some mental health issues.
Are you going to raise Maybe they seriously turned her down from FMLA leave, yeah, which they're supposed to give.
You.
Patrick, mental health issues.
Yeah, we're
actually kind of saying this tongue in cheek, but in all seriousness, nice. Mental health issues covered by FMLA, right?
Yeah, they are. And so is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I don't know what is causing her to bite her colleagues. Maybe it is something that's protected. And maybe they should have been an accommodation, some sort of mouth guard.
Well, she would have had to put them on notice first that she had the issue.
Well, and then they would have had after to the first bite, they would have been on notice that, you know, so they would have had that discussion.
I want to ask Mike a question.
Oh.
I'm going to pivot off the biting thing. You guys both done with that? Any more jokes? Yeah. Not a single vampire thing came up. That's good. Good work, guys.
No,
you left that where it was.
I think we've sucked our teeth into it. Sucked our teeth into it enough.
Yeah.
All right. So, Patrick, you were on my show on Wednesday, Your Money Matters. Yeah. I asked you straight up, will AI take over paralegals? And you said no. And I kind of rolled my eyes a little bit because I'm like, people are going to use ChatGPT. And then there's this story that just came out that lawyers for the Chicago Housing Authority had submitted a case that was not right. It didn't exist, pardon me.
Yeah.
And this has happened a few times now.
It has.
Because, again, to recap, ChatGPT, generative AI, it culls through all the internet that's ever been interneted, and it comes up with ideas for things. And a lot of times it's useful, and if you use it the right way, it's great, but it hallucinates and makes things up. So, Mike Leonard, I ask you, is AI useful for paralegals these days in coming up with summaries if they use it correctly? Or do you think that's actually going to hurt the paralegal profession or outright almost eliminate paralegals?
Well, it's a dangerous game to do case law summaries based off of ChatGPT AI. So you have to go to the source like Westlaw, Lexis, get the case, look at it. So that's dangerous. But there's a huge amount of legal work that's being done that's really in jeopardy from AI, from reviewing documents to even, I think, in a short couple of years, brief writing, because all the real cases will be in real databases where, of course, if you can teach a first-year law student or someone just out of law school to write a brief based upon finding the applicable cases and applying the law to your facts, of course, AI is going to be able to do that. So, and there's all sorts of other tasks, I think, that are going to be in danger and jeopardy of you know, going away. But
doesn't it even the playing field for defendants or people in cases if they can have law firms that you don't rely on just the people that know how to search for things the best, but now everyone has equal footing to find old case law to make their cases.
Yep. No, that's a good argument. That is a good argument.
Yes.
Yes, well, it is, but especially in cases where tons of documents are produced and, you know, it's a kind of a David and Goliath thing. But to your point, it's always going to be an issue. If a brief is filed and the case doesn't exist, that is a huge credibility problem. So is it going to do away with? No, because AI is not perfect. It's never going to be perfect. Just like people aren't perfect. So they, you know, there'll continue to be issues like this. I just don't, it's going to allow people to use the tool to make their jobs more efficient. I don't think it's going to displace people like paralegals and a lot of transactional stuff even, because you need people to do those deals.
Yeah.
The paperwork is something altogether different, but AI can make a mistake too. So
of course it can. I just think that, and I think we're all saying the same thing, a paralegal who knows how to use it well is going to be better than a paralegal that says, I'm not touching it. Right, well, like
but then they'll be trained to learn how to use it, but they won't lose their job. That's my point.
I 100% disagree with Patrick in a sense that I think it will cost a lot of jobs over the next 5 to 10 years, because a lot of these things that are done will be able to be done in a rote manner by these systems once they're at a level of more perfected. So it will cost a lot of jobs within the legal industry. Since I've never done a transaction my whole life, I would think it would have a keen impact upon them who are assembling documents, maybe using paragraphs and things they've used in other deals. I think that would be put the transactional world in jeopardy, but let's have a transactional or a call up.
I think that these stories that do come out are embarrassing when they happen. They're wrong that they happen. People should double check their work. But back to my original point, anything that levels the playing field in this world that allows people more access to true information when possible is brilliant. It's a great thing. And it's great beyond law. It's to be able to have information at your fingertips that can be given to you about world history, about U.S. history. Yes, you have to check your facts. You've always had to do that. Books have printed wrong things. I mean, yes, to an nth degree. But if it levels the playing field of equal opportunity to access of information, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, I don't think it will do away with jobs. I think it will cost some jobs. I don't disagree with that.
312-332-7800 is me. How you reach Patrick Dolan for what?
Employment laws and any kind of workplace issue.
Mike Dolan. Mike Leonard.
Sorry. Oh, my God.
Mike Leonard.
Sorry, Mike.
What disrespect. Anybody who's been charged with or being investigated for any state or federal criminal activities or is a whistleblower.
What's the number?
312-380-6559. Any lyrics for the road, John?
No. Congratulations on the wedding tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, guys.
Great stuff. All right, let's take a break. We're done. News from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom next. You won't hear me next week. You'll hear me on this show next week. I'm going to take a week off from Your Money Matters, though. See you on the other side, everybody.